Strange, the kid crooned, his eyes huge, his grin enormous. Sweat stood out on that pale doll's forehead in perfect clear drops. Just one more. It ended in a hurry. Trashcan Man felt the right rear of the car slip suddenly outward and sharply downward. He heard a falling mill race, first of pebbles, then of larger stones. He screamed. The kid cursed horribly, changed down to first gear, and floored the accelerator. From the left, where they had been inching by the overturned corpse of a VW microbus, came a squall of grinding metal. "Fly!" the kid screamed. "Just like a big-ass bird! Fly! Goddammit, fly!" The Deuce Coupe's rear wheels spun. For a moment, their shift toward the drop seemed to be increasing. Then the car jerked forward, lurched up, and they were back on the road on the far side of the pileup, laying rubber.
"I told you she'd do it!" the kid screamed triumphantly. "God damn, did we do it? Did we do it, Trashy, you fucking chicken shit suckhole?"
"We did it," Trashcan Man said quietly. He was twitching all over. He couldn't seem to control it. And then, for the second time since meeting the kid, he unwittingly said the one thing that could have saved his life. Had he not said it, the kid surely would have killed him. It would have been his queer way of celebrating. "Good driving, champ," he said. He had never called anyone champ in his whole life before now.
"Ah, not that great," the kid said patronizingly.
"There's at least two other guys in the country could have done it. You believe that, Happy Crappy?"
"If you say so, kid."
"Don't tell me, sweetheart, I'll fucking tell you. Well, on we go, all in a day's work." But they did not go on for long. The kid's Deuce Coupe was stopped for good 15 minutes later, 1,800 miles or more from its point of origin in Shreveport, Louisiana.
"I don't believe it," the kid said. "I don't motherfucking believe it."
He threw open the driver's side door and jumped out, the quarter-full bottle of Rebel Yell still clutched in his left hand.
"Get out of my road!"
the kid roared, dancing about in his grotesquely high-heeled boots, a tiny natural force of destruction like an earthquake in a bottle.
"Get out of my road, motherfuckers! You're dead! Y'all belong in the motherfucking boneyard! You got no business in my fucking road!"
He threw the Rebel Yell bottle and it flew end over end, spraying amber droplets. It crashed into 100 pieces against the side of an old Porsche. The kid stood silent, panting and reeling a little on his feet. The problem was nothing so simple as a 4-car pileup this time. This time, the problem was nothing but traffic. The eastbound lanes were here divided from those westbound by a grassy median strip about 10 yards across. And the Deuce Coupe probably could have made it from one side of the highway to the other, but the condition of both arteries was the same. The 4 lanes were crowded with 6 lanes of traffic, bumper to bumper and side to side. The breakdown lanes were as full as the travel lanes. Some drivers had even attempted to use the median itself, although it was rough and ungraded and full of rocks which punched out of the thin gray soil like dragon's teeth. Perhaps there had been high-hung 4-wheel-drive vehicles which had had some success there. But what Trashcan saw on the median strip was an automobile graveyard of crashed, bashed, and mashed Detroit rolling iron. It was as if a mass madness had infected all the drivers and they had decided to hold an apocalyptic demolition derby or lunatic gymkhana here high up on I-70. Colorado Rocky Mountain High, Trashcan Man thought. I've seen it raining Chevys in the sky. He almost giggled and hurriedly covered his mouth. If the kid heard him giggling now, he would most likely never giggle again. The kid came striding back in his high-heeled boots, his carefully coiffed hair gleaming. His face was that of a dwarf basilisk. His eyes were bulging with fury.
"I'm not leaving my fucking car," he said. "You hear me? No way, I'm not leaving it. You get walking, Trashy. You walk up there and see how far this motherfucking traffic jam goes. Maybe it's a truck in the road, I don't know. I know we can't fucking backtrack. We lost the shoulder. We go all the way down. But if it's just a stalled truck or something, I don't give a rat's ass. I'll jump these sons of whores at one time and run 'em right the fuck over the edge. I can do it, and you better believe that, Happy Crappy. Get moving, son."
Trash didn't argue. He began to walk carefully up the road, weaving in and out of the packed cars. He was ready to duck and run if the kid started shooting, but the kid didn't. When Trash Can had walked what he judged to be a safe distance, i.e. out of pistol range, he climbed atop a tanker truck and looked back. The kid, miniature street punk from hell, truly doll-sized at this half-a-mile distance, was leaning against the side of his Ducey, having a drink. Trash Can Man thought of waving, and then decided it might be a bad idea. The Trash Can Man started his walk that day at about 10:30 in the morning, Mountain Daylight time. Walking was slow. He often had to scramble over the hoods and roofs of cars and trucks, they were so tightly packed together. And by the time he got to the first tunnel closed sign, it was already 3:15 in the afternoon. He had made about 12 miles. 12 miles wasn't so much, not to someone who'd crossed 20% of the country on a bicycle, but considering the obstacles, he thought 12 miles was pretty awesome. He could have gone back long ago to tell the kid it was impossible, if that was he'd ever had any intentions of going back. He didn't, of course. Trash Can Man had never read much history. After the electroshock therapy, reading had gotten sort of tough for him. But he didn't need to know that in times of old, kings and emperors had often killed the bearers of bad news out of simple pique. What he did know was enough. He had seen enough of the kid to know he didn't ever want to see any more. He stood pondering the sign, black letters on an orange diamond-shaped field. It had been knocked over and was lying beneath one wheel of what looked like the world's oldest Yugo. Tunnel closed. What tunnel? He peered ahead, shading his eyes, and thought he could see something. He walked on another 300 yards, scrambling over cars when he had to, and came to an alarming confusion of crashed vehicles and dead bodies. Some of the cars and trucks had been burned to the axles. Many were army vehicles. Many of the bodies were dressed in khaki. Beyond the scene of this battle, Trash was pretty sure that's what it had been, the traffic jam began again. And beyond it, east and west, the traffic disappeared into the twin bores of what a huge sign bolted to the living rock proclaimed to be the Eisenhower Tunnel. He walked closer, heart bumping, not knowing just what he intended. Those twin bores punching their way into the rock intimidated him, and as he drew closer, intimidation became outright terror. He would have understood Larry Underwood's feelings about the Lincoln Tunnel perfectly. In that instant, they were unknowing soul brothers, the shared soul emotion one of stark fear. The main difference was that, while the Lincoln Tunnel's pedestrian catwalk was set high off the roadbed, here it was low enough so that some of the cars had actually attempted to run along the side, with one pair of wheels up on the catwalk and the other on the road. The tunnel was 2 miles long. The only way to negotiate it would be to crawl along from car to car in the pitch dark. It would take hours. Trash Can Man felt his bowels turn to water. He stood looking at the tunnel for a long time. Larry Underwood, over a month before, had gone into his tunnel in spite of his fear. After a long contemplation, Trash Can Man turned away and began to walk back toward the kid. His shoulders slumped, the corners of his mouth trembling. It was not just the absence of any easy place to walk which made him turn back, or the length of the tunnel. Trash, who had lived his whole life in Indiana, had no idea how long the Eisenhower Tunnel was. Larry Underwood had been moved, and perhaps controlled, by an underlying streak of self-interest, by the simple logic of survival. New York was an island, and he had to get off. The tunnel was the quickest way. So he would walk through as quick as he could. He would do it the way you held your nose and swallowed fast when you knew the medicine was going to taste bad. Trash Can Man was a beaten thing, used to accepting the punchings and pummelings of both fate and his own inexplicable nature, and doing so with a bowed head. He had been further unmanned, brainwashed almost, by his cataclysmic encounter with the kid. He had been whooshed along at speeds high enough to induce brain damage. He had been threatened with extinction if he could not drink a whole can of beer without stopping and without throwing up afterward. He had been sodomized with a pistol barrel. he had been nearly dumped 1,000 feet straight down from the edge of the turnpike. On top of this, could he summon enough courage to crawl through a hole bored straight through the base of a mountain, a hole where he might encounter who knew what horrors in the dark? He could not. Others, maybe, but not the trash can man. And there was also a certain logic in the idea of turning back. It was the logic of the beaten and the half-mad, true, but it still had its own perverse charm. He was not on an island. If he had to backtrack the rest of today and all day tomorrow in order to find a road that went over the mountains instead of through them, he would do it. He'd have to get by the kid, it was true, but he thought the kid might have changed his mind and left already, in spite of his declarations to the contrary. He might be dead drunk. He might even, although Trash really doubted that such extraordinary good luck would ever come his way, be simply dead. At the worst, if the kid was still there, watching and waiting, Trash Can could wait until dark and then creep past him, like a weasel, some small animal in the underbrush. Then he would just continue on to the east until he found the road he was looking for. He arrived back at the tanker truck from whose top he had last seen the kid and the kid's mythic deuce coupe, making better time on the return trip. This time he did not climb up to where he would be clearly silhouetted against the evening sky, but began to crawl from car to car on his hands and knees, trying to be very quiet. The kid might be alert and on watch. With a guy like the kid, you just couldn't tell, and it didn't pay to take chances. He found himself wishing he had taken one of the soldiers' guns, even though he had never used a gun in his life. He kept crawling, the road pebbles biting painfully into his claw hand. It was 8 o'clock, and the sun had gone behind the mountains. Trash Can stopped behind the hood of the Porsche the kid had thrown his liquor bottle at, and carefully raised his eyes over it. Yes, there was the kid's deuce coupe, with its flamboyant flake-gold paint, its convex windshield and shark fin cutting at the bruise-colored evening sky. The kid was slumped behind the day-glow steering wheel, his eyes closed, his mouth open. Trash Can Man's heart thundered a percussive victory song in his chest. "Dead drunk," his heartbeat proclaimed in syllables of two. "Dead drunk, by God, dead drunk." Trash thought he could be 20 miles east of here before the kid even woke up to his hangover. Still, he was careful. He skittered from car to car like a water bug crossing the still surface of a pond, skirting the deuce coupe on his left, hurrying across the increasing gaps. Now the deucey was at 9 o'clock on his left, now 7, now 6, and directly behind him. Now to put distance between him and that crazy, "You prick stupid cocksucker, you hold still!" Trash froze on his hands and knees. He made wee-wee in his pants, and his mind dissolved into a madly fluttering blackbird of panic. He turned around little by little, the tendons in his neck creaking like the hinges of a door in a haunted house. And there stood the kid, resplendent in an iridescent shirt of green and gold and a pair of sun-faded cords. There was a .45 in each hand, and a horrible grimace of hate and rage on his face. "I was just checking down this way," Trash Can Man heard himself saying, "to make sure the coast was clear."
"Sure, on your hands and knees you was checking, dinkweed. I'll clear your motherfucking coast. Stand up here."
Trash Can somehow gained his feet and kept them by holding onto the door handle of a car on his right. The twin bores of the kid's matched set of .45s looked every bit as big as the twin bores of the Eisenhower Tunnel. He was looking at death now. He knew that. There were no right words to avert it this time. He offered up a silent prayer to the dark man.
"Please, if it be your will, my life for you." "What's up there?" the kid asked. "A wreck?" "A tunnel. It's jammed solid. That's why I came back, to tell you. Please, a tunnel," the kid groaned. "Jesus, hairy old bald-headed Christ." The scowl returned. "Are you lying to me, you fucking fairy?"
"No, I swear I'm not. The sign said Eisenhower Tunnel. I think that's what it said, but I have trouble with long words. I—"
"Shut your dough hole.
How far?
8 miles, maybe even more. The kid was silent for a moment, looking west along the turnpike. Then he fixed Trash Can Man with a glittery gaze.
You try and tell me this traffic jam's 8 miles long, you lying sack of shit?
The kid thumbed the triggers on both guns up to half-cock. Trash Can, who wouldn't have known half-cock from full-cock and full-cock from a bag of frogs, screeched like a woman and put his hands over his eyes.
No kidding, he screamed. No kidding, I swear, I swear.
The kid looked at him for a long time. At last he lowered the hammers on his guns.
I'm gonna kill you, Trashy, he said, smiling. I'm gonna take your motherfucking life. But first we're gonna walk back to that pile-up we squeaked by this morning. You're gonna push the van over the edge. Then I'm gonna go back and find another way around. Not gonna leave my fucking car, he added petulantly. No how, no way.
Please don't kill me, Trash Can whispered. Please don't.
If you can get that VW van over the side in less than 15 minutes, maybe I won't, the kid said. You believe that, Happy Crappy?
Yes, Trash said.
But he had gotten a look into those preternaturally glittering eyes, and he did not believe it at all. They walked back to the pile-up, Trash Can Man walking in front of the kid on wobbling rubber legs. The kid walked mincingly, his leather jacket creaking softly in its secret folds. There was a vague, almost sweet smile on his doll-like lips. By the time they got to the pile-up, dusk was almost gone. The VW microbus was on its side, the corpses of the 3 or 4 occupants a tangle of arms and legs that was mercifully hard to see in the fast-failing light. The kid walked past the van and stood on the shoulder, looking at the place they had edged by some 10 hours before. One of the Deucey's tire tracks was still there, but the other had crumbled away with the embankment.
Nope, the kid said with finality. Never gonna make a fire here unless we do some moving and grooving first. Don't tell me, I'll tell you.
For one brief moment, Trash Can Man entertained the notion of rushing at the kid and trying to push him over the edge. Then the kid turned around. His guns were drawn and pointing casually at Trash Can's midriff.
Say, Trashy, you was thinking evil thoughts. Don't try to tell me no different. I can read you like a motherfucking book.
Trash Can shook his head violently back and forth in protest.
Don't you make a mistake with me, Trashy. That's the one thing in this wide world you don't want to do. Now get pushing on that van. You got 15 minutes.
There was an Austin parked nearby on the broken center line. The kid pulled open the passenger door, casually ripped out the bloated corpse of a teenage girl. Her arm came off in his hand, and he tossed it aside with the absent air of a man who is finished with the turkey drumstick he has been nibbling on, and sat down on the bucket seat with his feet out on the pavement. He gestured good-humoredly with his guns at the slumped, shuddering form of the Trash Can Man.
"Time's a-wasting, good buddy!"
He threw back his head and sang, "Oh, here comes Johnny with his pecker in his hand. He's a one-ball man, and he's off to the rodeo!"
"That's right, Trash, you fucking wet end. Get you back into it. Only 12 minutes left. Allemand left and Allemand right. Come on, you fucking dummy. Get your right foot right!"
Trash leaned against the microbus, bunched his legs, and pushed. The microbus moved perhaps 2 inches toward the drop. In his heart, hope, that indestructible weed of the human heart, had begun to bloom again. The kid was irrational, impulsive, what Carly Yates and his pool hall buddies would have called crazier than a shithouse rat. Maybe if he actually got the van over the side and cleared the way for the kid's precious deuce coupe, the lunatic would let him live. Maybe. He lowered his head, gripped the edge of the VW's frame, and shoved with all his might. Pain flared in his recently burned arm, and he knew that the fragile new tissue would soon rip open. Then the pain would become agony. The bus moved 3 inches. Sweat dripped from Trash Can's brow and ran into his eyes, stinging like warm engine oil.
"Oh, here comes Johnny with his pecker in his hand. He's a one-ball man, and he's off to the rodeo,"
the kid sang.
"Well, Allemand left and Allemand right."
The song broke off like a brittle twig. Trash Can Man looked up apprehensively. The kid had come out of the Austin's passenger seat. He was standing in profile to Trash, staring across their half of the turnpike toward the eastbound lanes. A rocky, brushy slope rose beyond them, blotting out half the sky.
"What the fuck was that?" the kid whispered.
I didn't hear any...
Then he did hear something. He heard a small rattle of pebbles and stones on the other side of the highway. His dream recurred to him in sudden, total recall that froze his blood and evaporated all the spit in his mouth.
"Who's there?" the kid shouted. "You better answer me! Answer, goddammit, or I start shooting!"
And he was answered, but not by any human voice. A howl rose up in the night like a hoarse siren, first climbing and then dropping rapidly down to a guttural growl.
"Holy Jesus," the kid said, and his voice was suddenly thin.
Coming down the slope on the far side of the turnpike and crossing the median strip were wolves, gaunt gray timber wolves, their eyes red, their jaws gaping and adrip. There were more than 24 of them. Trash Can, in an ecstasy of terror, made wee-wee in his pants again. The kid stepped around the trunk of the Austin, leveled his .45s, and began firing. Flame licked from the barrels. The sound of the shots echoed and re-echoed from the mountain faces, making it sound as if artillery were at work. Trash Can Man cried out and poked his index fingers in his ears. The night breeze tattered the gun smoke, fresh and ripe and hot. Its cordite aroma stung his nose. The wolves came on, no faster and no slower, at a fast walk. Their eyes. Trash Can Man found himself unable to look away from their eyes. They were not the eyes of ordinary wolves. Of that he was quite convinced. They were the eyes of their master, he thought. Their master and his master. Suddenly he remembered his prayer and he was afraid no longer. He took his fingers out of his ears. He ignored the wetness spreading at his crotch. He began to smile. The kid had emptied both of his guns, dropping 3 of the wolves in so doing. He holstered the .45s without making an attempt to reload, and turned west. He went about 10 paces and then stopped. More wolves were padding down the westbound lanes, weaving in and out of the dark hulks of the stalled cars like tattered streamers of mist. One of them raised its snout to the sky and howled. Its cry was joined by a second, the second by a third, the third by a whole chorus. Then they came on again. The kid began to back up. He was trying to load one of his guns now, but the shells were spilling out between his nerveless fingers. Suddenly he gave up. The gun fell out of his hand and clunked on the road. As if it had been a signal, the wolves rushed him. With a high, reedy scream of fear, the kid turned and ran for the Austin. As he ran, his second pistol tumbled from its low holster and bounced off the road. With a low, ripping growl, the wolf closest to him sprang just as the kid dove into the Austin and slammed the door. He just made it. The wolf bounced off the door, growling, its red eyes rolling horribly. It was joined by the others, and in moments the Austin was ringed with wolves. From inside, the kid's face was a small white moon looking out. Then one of the wolves was coming toward the Trash Can Man, its triangular head held low, its eyes glowing like storm lamps.
"My life for you."
Steadily, now not in the least afraid, Trash went to meet it. He held out his burned hand, and the wolf licked it. After a moment it sat at his feet, curling its ragged, brushy tail about its withers. The kid was staring at him, his mouth hanging open. Smiling into his eyes, Trash Can Man gave him the finger. Both fingers. And he screamed,
"Fuck you! You're shut down! Do you hear me? Do you believe that, Happy Crappy? Shut down! Don't tell me! I'll tell you!"
The wolf's mouth closed gently on Trash Can's good hand. He looked down. It was standing again, tugging him lightly. Tugging him west.
"All right," Trash Can said serenely. "Okay, boy."
He began to walk and the wolf fell in right behind him, walking like a well-trained dog at heel. As they walked away, 5 others joined them from amid the stalled cars. Now he walked with 1 wolf ahead of him, 1 behind him, and 2 on each side, like an escorted dignitary. He paused once and looked back over his shoulder. He never forgot what he saw. A ring of wolves sitting patiently in a gray circle around the little Austin, and the pale circle of the kid's face staring out, his mouth working behind the window glass. The wolves seemed to grin up at the kid, their tongues lolling out of their mouths. They seemed to be asking him just how long it would be before he kicked the dark man out of old lost wages on his ass. Just how long? Trashcan Man wondered how long those wolves would sit around the little Austin, wringing it in a circle of teeth. The answer, of course, was as long as it took. 2 days, three, maybe even four. The kid would sit there looking out. Nothing to eat, unless the teenage girl had had a passenger, that was. Nothing to drink, the afternoon temperature in the car's small interior maybe as high as 130 degrees, what with the greenhouse effect. The dark man's lapdogs would wait until the kid starved to death, or until he got crazy enough to open the door and try to make a run for it. Trashcan Man giggled in the darkness. The kid wasn't very big. He wouldn't make much more than a mouthful for each of them. And what they did get might well poison them. "Am I right?" he cried and cackled up at the bright stars. "Don't tell me if you believe that happy crappy. I'll motherfucking tell you!" His gray ghostly companions padded gravely along all about him, taking no notice of Trashcan Man's shouts. When they reached the kid's deuce coop, the wolf at his heel padded over to it, sniffed at one of the wide ovals, and then, grinning sardonically, lifted his leg and made wee-wee on it. Trashcan Man had to laugh. He laughed until tears squirted from his eyes and ran down his cracked, stubbled cheeks. His madness, like a fine skillet dish, now wanted only for the desert sun to simmer it and complete it, to give it that final subtle touch of flavor. They walked, the Trashcan Man and his escorts. As the traffic grew thicker, the wolves either squirmed under cars with their bellies dragging on the road or padded over hoods and roofs near him, sanguine, silent companions with red eyes and bright teeth. When, sometime after midnight, they reached the Eisenhower Tunnel, Trashcan did not hesitate but worked his way steadily into the maw of the westbound side. How could he be afraid now? How could he be afraid with guardians like these? It was a long trip, and he had lost all track of time before it had little more than begun. He groped blindly forward from one car to the next. Once his hand plunged into something wet and sickeningly soft, and there was a horrible whoosh of stinking gas. Even then he did not falter. From time to time he saw red eyes in the dark, always up ahead, always leading him forward. A time later he sensed a new freshness in the air and began to hurry, once losing his balance and plunging from the hood of one car to crack his skull painfully on the bumper of the next. A short time after that, he looked up and saw the stars again, now paling before the onset of dawn. He was out. His guardians had faded away, but Trashcan fell to his knees and gave thanks in a long, rambling, disjointed prayer. He had seen the hand of the dark man at work, and he had seen it plain. In spite of all he had been through since he had awakened the previous morning to see the kid admiring his hairdo in the mirror of the Golden Motel room, Trash was too exalted to sleep. He walked instead, putting the tunnel behind him. The traffic was choked on the westbound side of the tunnel, too, but it had cleared out enough to walk comfortably before he had gone 2 miles. Across the median in the eastbound lanes, the stream of cars that had been waiting to use the tunnel stretched on and on. At noon, he began to come down from Vale Pass into Vale itself, passing the condominiums and the singles apartment complexes. Now weariness had almost overcome him. He broke a window, unlocked a door, found a bed. And that was all he remembered until early the next morning. The beauty of religious mania is that it has the power to explain everything. Once God, or Satan, is accepted as the first cause of everything which happens in the mortal world, nothing is left to chance, or change. Once such incantatory phrases as, "We see now through a glass darkly," and "Mysterious are the ways he chooses his wonders to perform," are mastered, logic can be happily tossed out the window. Religious mania is one of the few infallible ways of responding to the world's vagaries, because it totally eliminates pure accident. To the true religious maniac, it's all on purpose. It was quite likely for this reason that the trash can man talked to a crow for nearly 20 minutes on the road west of Vale, convinced it was either an emissary of the Dark Man or the Dark Man himself. The crow regarded him silently from its perch on the high telephone wire for a long time, not flying away until it was bored or hungry, or until Trash Can's outpouring of praise and promises of loyalty were complete. He got another bike near Grand Junction, and by July 25th he had been speeding across western Utah on Route 4, which connects I-89 on the east to the great southwestern tending I-15, which goes from north of Salt Lake City all the way to San Bernardino, California. And when the front wheel of his new bike suddenly decided to part company from the rest of the machine and go speeding off into the desert on its own, Trash Can Man was pitched over the handlebars to land on his head, a crash that should have fractured his skull. He was doing 40 when it happened and wearing no helmet. Yet he was able to stand up less than 5 minutes later with blood streaming over his face from half a dozen cuts and lacerations, able to do his shuffling, grimacing little dance, able to chant, "Siabola, my life for you! Siabola, bump-de-bump-de-bump!" There is really nothing so comforting to the beaten of spirit or the broken of skull than a good strong dose of "Thy will be done." On August 7th, Lloyd Henreid came to the room in which the dehydrated and semi-delirious Trash Can Man had been installed the day before. It was a fine room on the 30th floor of the MGM Grand. There was a round bed with silk sheets and a round mirror which looked to be the exact same size as the bed mounted on the ceiling. Trash Can Man looked at Lloyd. "How you feeling, Trash?" Lloyd asked, looking back. "Good," Trash Can Man said. "Better." "Some food and water and rest, that's all you needed," Lloyd said. "I brought you some clean clothes. Had to guess at the sizes." "They look fine." Trash had never really been able to remember his sizes. He took the jeans and the work shirt Lloyd offered. "Come on down to breakfast when you're dressed," Lloyd said. He spoke almost deferentially. "Most of us eat in the deli." "Okay, sure." The deli hummed with conversation, and he paused outside and around the corner, suddenly overcome with fright. They would look up at him when he came in. They would look up and laugh. Someone would start giggling in the back of the room, someone else would join in, and then the whole place would be an uproar of laughter and pointing fingers. "Hey, put away your matches, here comes the Trash Can Man." "Hey, Trash, what old Lady Semple say when you torched your pension check? Wet the bed much, Trashy?" Sweat popped out on his skin, making him feel slimy in spite of the shower he'd taken after Lloyd left. He remembered his face in the bathroom mirror, covered with slowly healing scabs, his body too gaunt, his eyes too small for their yawning sockets. Yes, they would laugh. He listened to the hum of conversation, the clink of silverware, and thought he should just slink away. Then he thought of the way the wolf had taken his hand, so gently, and had led him away from the kid's metal tomb, and Trash squared his shoulders and walked inside. A few people looked up briefly, then went back to their meals and their conversations. Lloyd, at a big table in the middle of the room, raised an arm and waved him over. Trash threaded his way among the tables and under a darkened electronic Keno tote board. There were three other people at the table. They were all eating ham and scrambled eggs. "Serve yourself," Lloyd said. "It's a steam table kind of thing." Trash Can Man got a tray and served himself. The man behind the counter, large and dressed in dirty cook's whites, watched him. "Are you Mr. Horgan?" Trash Can Man asked timidly. Horgan grinned, exposing gapped teeth. "Yeah, but we won't get nowhere with you calling me that, boy. You call me Whitey. You feeling a little better? When you came in, you looked like the wrath of God." "Much better, sure." "Dig in those eggs, all you want. Go light on the home fries, though, I would at least. Them taters is old and tough. Good to have you here, boy." "Thanks," Trash said. He went back to Lloyd's table.
Trash, this here is Ken DeMott. The fellow with the bald spot is Hector Drogon. And this kid trying to grow on his face what springs up wild in his asshole calls himself Ace High. They all nodded at him. This is our new boy, Lloyd said. Name's Trash Can Man. Hands were shaken all around. Trash started to dig into his eggs. He looked up at the young man with the scraggly beard and said in a low, polite voice, "Would you pass the salt, please, Mr. High?" There was a moment of surprise as they looked at each other, and then they all burst into laughter. Trash stared at them, feeling the panic rise in his chest, and then he heard the laughter, really heard it, with his mind as well as his ears, and understood that there was no meanness in it. No one here was going to ask him why he hadn't burned down the school instead of the church. No one here was going to dun him about Old Lady Semple's pension check. He could smile, too, if he wanted. And he did.
"Mr. High!" Hector Drogon was giggling. "Oh, Ace, you just been hit, Mr. High. I love it. Mr. High! Man, that is so fucking rich."
Ace High handed Trash Can the salt.
"Just Ace, my man. That'll get me every time. You don't call me Mr. High, and I won't call you Mr. Man. That a deal?"
"Okay," Trash Can Man said, still smiling. "That's fine."
"Oh, Mr. High,"
Heck Drogon said in a coy falsetto. Then he burst into laughter again.
"Ace, you never gonna live that down. I swear you won't."
"Maybe not, but I'm sure God gonna live it up," Ace High said, and got up with his plate for more eggs. His hand closed for a moment on Trash Can Man's shoulder as he went. The hand was warm and solid. It was a friendly hand that did not squeeze or pinch. Trash Can Man dug into his eggs, feeling warm and good inside. This warmth and goodness was so foreign to his nature that it almost felt like a disease. As he ate, he tried to isolate it, understand it. He looked up, looked at the faces around him, and thought he might understand what it was. Happiness. "What a good bunch of people," he thought. And on the heels of that, "I'm home." That day he was left on his own to sleep, but the next day he was bussed up to Boulder Dam with a lot of other people. There they spent the day wrapping copper core wire around the spindles of burned-out motors. He worked at a bench with a view of the water, Lake Mead, and no one supervised him. Trash Can Man assumed that there was no foreman or anyone like that around because everyone was as in love with what they were doing as he was himself. He learned differently the next day. It was 10:15 in the morning. Trash Can Man was sitting on his bench, wrapping copper wire, his mind a million miles away as his fingers did their work. He was composing a psalm of praise to the dark man in his mind. It had occurred to him that he should get a large book, a book with a capital B, actually, and begin to write some of his thoughts about him down. It would be the sort of book, capital B, people might want to read someday. People who felt about him as Trash did. Ken DeMott came to his bench, and Ken looked pale and frightened under his desert tan. "Come on," he said. "Work's over. We're going back to Vegas. Everyone, the buses are outside."
"Huh? Why?"
Trash Can blinked up at him.
"I don't know. It's his order. Lloyd passed it along. Get your ass in gear, Trashy. It's best not to ask questions when the hard case is involved."
So he didn't. Outside, on Hoover Drive, three Las Vegas public school buses were parked with their engines idling. Men and women were climbing aboard. There was little talk. The mid-morning ride back to Vegas was the antithesis of the usual commutes to and from work. There was no horseplay, little conversation, and none of the usual light banter that passed between the 20 or so women and the 30 or so men. Everyone had drawn into himself or herself. As they neared the city, Trash Can Man heard one of the men sitting across from the aisle from him say quietly to his seatmate,
"It's Heck. Heck Drogon. God damn it, how does that spook find things out?"
"Shut up," the other said,
and gave Trash Can Man a mistrustful glance. Trash averted his gaze and looked out the window at the passing desert. He was once again troubled in his mind.
"Oh, Jesus," one of the women said as they filed off the bus, but hers was the only comment.
Trash Can looked around, puzzled. Everyone was here, it looked like, everyone in Cibola. They had all been called back, with the exception of a few scouts that might be anywhere from the Mexican Peninsula to West Texas. They were gathered in a loose semicircle around the fountain, 6 and 7 deep, more than 400 in all. Some of those in the back were standing on hotel chairs so they could see, and until Trash Can drew closer, he thought it was the fountain they were looking at. Craning his neck, he could see there was something lying on the lawn in front of the fountain, but he couldn't see what it was. A hand grasped his elbow. It was Lloyd. His face looked white and strained.
"I've been looking for you. He wants to see you later. Meantime, we got this. God, I hate these. Come on, I need help and you're elected."
Trash Can Man's head was whirling. He wanted to see him. Him. But in the meantime, there was this. Whatever this was. "What, Lloyd? What is it?" Lloyd didn't answer. Still holding lightly to Trash Can Man's arm, he led him toward the fountain. The crowd parted before them, almost shrank from them. The narrow corridor they passed through seemed to be insulated with a still cold layer of loathing and fear. Standing at the front of the crowd was Whitney Horgan. He was smoking a cigarette. One of his hush puppies was propped on the object Trash hadn't been quite able to make out before. It was a wooden cross. Its vertical piece was about 12 feet long. It looked like a crude lowercase T.
"Everyone here?" Lloyd asked.
"Yeah," Whitey said. "I guess they are. Winky took roll call. You got 9 guys out of state. Flag said never mind about them. How are you holding up, Lloyd?"
"I'll be fine," Lloyd said. "Well, not fine, but you know, I'll get through it."
Whitey cocked his head toward Trash Can Man.
"How much does the kid know?"
"I don't know anything," Trash Can said, more confused than ever. Hope, awe, and dread were all in dubious battle within him.
"What is this? Someone said something about heck."
"Yeah, it's heck," Lloyd said. "He's been freebasing. Fucking blow, don't I hate the goddamn fucking blow."
"Go on, Whitey, tell him to bring him out."
Whitey moved away from Lloyd and Trash, stepping over a rectangular hole in the ground. The hole had been throated with cement. It looked just the right size and depth to take the butt end of the cross. As Whitney Whitey Horgan trotted up the wide steps between the gold pyramids, Trash Can Man felt all the spit in his mouth dry up. He suddenly turned, first to the silent crowd waiting in its crescent formation under the blue sky, then to Lloyd, who stood pale and silent, looking at the cross and picking the white head of a pimple on his chin.
"We nail him up?"
Trash Can managed at last.
"Is that what this is about?"
Lloyd reached suddenly into the pocket of his faded shirt.
"You know, I got something for you. He gave it to me to give to you. I can't make you take it, but it's a goddamn good thing for me that I remembered to at least make the offer. Do you want it?"
From his breast pocket, he drew a fine gold chain with a black jet stone on the end of it. The stone was flawed with a tiny red spot, as was Lloyd's own. He dangled it before Trash Can Man's eyes like a hypnotist's amulet. The truth was in Lloyd's eyes, too clear not to be recognized, and Trash Can Man knew he could never weep and grovel. Not before him, not before anybody, but especially not before him, and claim he hadn't understood. "Take this and you take everything," Lloyd's eyes said. "And what's a part of everything? Why, Heck Drogon, of course. Heck and the cement-lined hole in the ground, the hole just big enough to take the butt end of Heck's cross tree." He reached for it slowly. His hand paused just before the outstretched fingers could touch the gold chain.
"This is my last chance. My last chance to be Donald Merwin Elbert."
But another voice, one which spoke with greater authority, but with a certain gentleness, like a cool hand on a fevered brow, told him that the time of choices had long since passed. If he chose Donald Merwin Elbert now, he would die. He had sought the dark man of his own free will, if there is such a thing for the trash-can men of the world, had accepted the dark man's favors. The dark man had saved him from dying at the hands of the kid. That the dark man might have sent the kid for just that purpose never crossed trash-can man's mind. And surely that meant his life was now a debt he owed to that same dark man, the man some of them here called the Walkin' Dude. His life. Had he not himself offered it again and again? But your soul. Did you offer your soul as well? In for a penny, in for a pound, the trash can man thought, and gently put one hand around the gold chain and the other around the dark stone. The stone was cold and smooth. He held it in his fist for a moment just to see if he could warm it up. He didn't think he would be able to, and he was right. So he put it around his neck, where it lay against his skin like a tiny ball of ice. But he didn't mind that icy feeling. That icy feeling counterbalanced the fire which was always in his mind. "Just tell yourself you don't know him," Lloyd said. "Heck, I mean. That's what I always do. It makes it easier. Two of the wide hotel doors banged open. Frantic, terrified screams floated across to them. The crowd sighed. A party of nine came down the steps. Hector Drogon was in the center. He was fighting like a tiger caught in a net. His face was dead pale except for two hectic blots of color riding high up on his cheekbones. Sweat was pouring off every inch of skin in rivers. He was mother naked. Five men were holding on to him. One of them was Ace High, the kid Heck had been ribbing about his name.
"Ace!" Hector was babbling. "Hey, Ace, what do you say? Little help for the kid, okay? Tell him to quit this, man. I can get clean, I swear to God, I can clean up my act. What do you say? Little help here, please, Ace!"
Ace High said nothing, simply tightened his grip on Heck's thrashing arm. It was answer enough. Hector Drogon began to scream again. He was dragged relentlessly across the pavilion and toward the fountain. Behind him, walking in line like a solemn undertaker's party, were three men. Whitney Horgan, carrying a large carpet bag, a man named Roy Hoops, with a stepladder, and Winky Winks, a bald man whose eyes twitched constantly. Winky was carrying a clipboard with a typed sheet of paper on it. Heck was dragged to the foot of the cross. A horrible yellow smell of fear was radiating out from him. His eyes rolled, showing the muddy whites, like the eyes of a horse left out in a thunderstorm.
"Hey, Trashy!"
he said hoarsely, as Roy Hoops set up the stepladder behind him.
"Trashcan man! Tell him to cut it out, buddy. Tell him I can get clean. Tell him a scare like this is better than all the fucking rehabs in the world. Tell him, man!"
Trashcan stared down at his feet. As he bent his neck, the black stone swung out from his chest and into his field of vision. The red flaw, the eye, seemed to be staring up at him fixedly.
"I don't know you," he mumbled.
From the tail of his eye he saw Whitey down on one knee, a cigarette dangling from the corner of his mouth, his left eye squinted against the smoke. He opened the carpet bag. He was taking out sharp wooden nails. To Trash Can Man's horrified gaze, they looked almost as big as tent pegs. He laid the nails on the grass and then removed a large wooden mallet from the carpet bag. In spite of the murmuring voices all around them, Trashcan Man's words seemed to have penetrated the panicky haze in Hector Drogon's mind.
"What do you mean you don't know me?" he cried wildly. "We had breakfast together just 2 days ago. You called the kid there Mr. High. What do you mean you don't know me, you chicken shit little liar?"
"I don't know you at all," Trash repeated, a little more clearly this time.
And what he felt was almost a sense of relief. All he saw here in front of him was a stranger who looked a bit like Carly Yates. His hand went to the stone and curled around it. Its coolness reassured him further.
"You liar!"
Heck screamed. He began to struggle again, his muscles flexing and pumping, the sweat trickling down his bare chest and arms.
"You liar! You do so know me, you do so, you liar!"
"No, I don't. I don't know you, and I don't want to know you."
Heck began to scream again. The four men holding him bore down, panting and out of breath.
"Go ahead," Lloyd said.
Heck was dragged backward. One of the men holding him stuck out a leg and tripped him. He landed half on the cross and half off it. Meanwhile, Winky had begun to read the typed sheet on his clipboard in a high voice that sliced through Heck's screams like the howl of a buzzsaw.
"Attention, attention, attention! By the order of Randall Flagg, leader of the people and first citizen, this man, Hector Alonzo Drogon by name, is ordered executed by an act of crucifixion, this penalty so ordered for the crime of drug use."
"No, no, no!"
Heck screamed in frenzied counterpoint. His left arm, greasy with sweat, escaped Ace High's hold, and instinctively Trash knelt and pinned the arm back down, forcing the wrist against an arm of the cross. A second later, Whitey was kneeling beside Trash Can with the wooden mallet and two of the crude nails. The cigarette still hung from the corner of his mouth. He looked like a man about to do a little job of carpentering in his backyard.
"Yeah, good, hold him just like that, Trash. I'll staple him. Won't take a minute."
"Drug use is not allowed in this society of the people because it impairs the user's ability to contribute fully to the society of the people,"
Winky was proclaiming. He spoke fast, like an auctioneer, and his eyes bunched and scrunched and wiggled.
"Specifically in this case, the accused, Hector Drogon, was found with freebasing paraphernalia and a large supply of cocaine."
Now Heck's screams had reached a pitch that might well have shattered crystal, if there had been any crystal around to shatter. His head lashed from side to side. There was foam on his lips. Ribbons of blood coursed down his arms as six of them, Trash Can Man included, lifted the cross into the cement pit. Now Hector Drogon was silhouetted against the sky, with his head thrown back in a rictus of pain.
"Is done for the good of this society of the people,"
Winky screamed relentlessly.
"This communication ends with a solemn warning and greetings to the people of Las Vegas. Let this bill of true facts be nailed above the miscreant's head, and let it be marked with the seal of the first citizen, Randall Flagg by name."
"Oh, my God, it hurts!"
Hector Drogon screamed from above them.
"Oh, my God, oh, God, God, God!"
The crowd remained for almost an hour, each person afraid to be remarked upon as having been the first to leave. There was disgust on many faces, a drowsy kind of excitement on many others, but if there was a common denominator, it was fear. Trash Can Man wasn't frightened, though. Why should he have been frightened? He hadn't known the man. He hadn't known him at all. It was 10:15 that night when Lloyd came back to Trash Can Man's room. He glanced at Trash and said, "You're dressed. Good. I thought you might have gone to bed already."
"No," Trash Can Man said.
"I'm up. Why?"
Lloyd's voice dropped.
"It's now, Trashy. He wants to see you. Flag."
"He..."
"Yeah."
Trash Can Man was transported.
"Where is he?"
"My life for him. Oh, yes."
"Top floor," Lloyd said. "He got in just after we finished burning Drogon's body. From the coast. He was just here when Whitey and I got back from the landfill. No one ever sees him come or go, Trash, but they always know when he's taken off again, or when he comes back. Come on, let's go."
4 minutes later, the elevator arrived at the top floor, and Trash Can Man, his face alight and his eyes goggling, stepped out. Lloyd did not. Trash turned toward him.
"Aren't you?"
Lloyd managed to smile, but it was a sorry affair.
"No, he wants to see alone. Good luck, Trash."
And before he could say anything else, the elevator door had slid shut and Lloyd was gone. Trash Can Man turned around. He was in a wide, sumptuous hallway. There were two doors, and the one at the end was slowly opening. It was dark in there, but Trash could see a form standing in the doorway. And eyes, red eyes. Heart thudding slowly in his chest, mouth dry, Trash Can Man started to walk toward that form. As he did, the air seemed to grow steadily cooler and cooler. Goosebumps rashed out on his sunbaked arms.
Somewhere deep inside him, the corpse of Donald Merwin Elbert rolled over in its grave and seemed to cry out. Then it was still again. "The trash can man," a low and charming voice said. "How good it is to have you here. How very good." The words fell like dust from his mouth.
My life for you.
Yes, the shape in the doorway said soothingly. Lips parted and white teeth showed in a grin. But I don't think it will come to that. Come in, let me look at you. His eyes overbright, his face as slack as the face of a sleepwalker, Trash Can Man stepped inside. The door closed, and they were in dimness. A terribly hot hand closed over Trash Can Man's icy one, and suddenly he felt at peace. Flag said, "There's work for you in the desert, Trash. Great work, if you want it."
"Anything," Trash Can Man whispered. "Anything."
Randall Flagg slipped an arm around his wasted shoulders. "I'm going to set you to burn," he said. "Come. Let's have something to drink and talk about it." And in the end, that burning was very great. Chapter 49. When Lucy Swan woke up, it was 15 minutes to midnight by the lady's pulsar watch she wore. There was silent heat lightning in the west where the mountains were. The Rocky Mountains, she amended with some awe. Before this trip, she had never been west of Philadelphia, where her brother-in-law lived. Had lived. The other half of the double sleeping bag was empty. That was what had awakened her. She thought of just rolling over and going back to sleep. He would come back to bed when he was ready. And then she got up and went quietly toward where she thought he would be, on the west side of camp. She went lithely, without disturbing a soul. Except for the judge, of course. 10 to midnight was his watch, and you'd never catch Judge Ferris nodding off on duty. The judge was 70, and he'd joined them in Joliet. There were 19 of them now, 15 adults, 3 children, and Joe. "Lucy," the judge said, his voice low.
"Yes. Did you see—"
A low chuckle. "Sure did. He's out by the highway. Same place as last night and the night before that." She drew closer to him and saw that his Bible was open on his lap.
"Judge, you'll strain your eyes doing that."
"Nonsense. Starlight's the best light for this stuff. Maybe the only light. How's this? Is there not an appointed time to man upon earth? Are not his days like the days of an hireling? As a servant earnestly desireth the shadow, and as an hireling looketh for the reward of his work, so am I made to possess months of vanity, and wearisome nights are appointed to me. When I lie down, I say, when shall I arise, and the night be gone? And I am full of tossings to and fro unto the dawning of the day." "Far out," Lucy said, without much enthusiasm. "Real nice, Judge."
"It's not nice. It's Job. There's nothing very nice in the book of Job, Lucy."
He closed the Bible.
"I am full of tossings to and fro unto the dawning of the day."
"That's your man, Lucy. That's Larry Underwood to a T."
"I know," she said, and sighed. "Now if I only knew what was wrong with him."
The judge, who had his suspicions, kept silent.
"It can't be the dreams," she said. "No one has them anymore unless Joe does, and Joe's different."
"Yes, he is, poor boy."
"And everyone's healthy, at least since Mrs. Volman died."
2 days after the judge joined them, a couple who introduced themselves as Dick and Sally Volman had thrown in with Larry and his assorted company of survivors. Lucy thought it extremely unlikely that the flu had spared a man and wife, and suspected that their marriage was common law and of extremely short duration. They were in their 40s and obviously very much in love. Then, a week ago, at the old woman's house in Hemingford Home, Sally Volman had gotten sick. They camped for 2 days, waiting helplessly for her to get better or die. She had died. Dick Volman was still with them, but he was a different man,
silent, thoughtful, pale. "He's taken that to heart, hasn't he?" she asked Judge Ferris.
Larry is a man who found himself